Live from Beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Gary Abernathy, political blogger and author of Mega Republicans Are Already Normal. Stephen Maynard Caliendo from North Central College, their dean. Judith Sherwin, a pro-Trump Republican. And later in the second hour tonight, we're going to be joined by Michael Massa. He is the president of Numbers USA and will be talking about the difference between the variety of immigration bills that are out there. There's H.R. 2, which is in the House. And then there is the one that the Senate rejected, or the House rejected, which was a bipartisan effort. And then last week there was the Laken Riley bill that passed the House. So we're going to try to separate what they all mean and which one is good, which one is bad, and can there ever be any compromise on any of these. But again, we begin with discussion of the State of the Union the other night, and my question to everybody, and I'm going to start with you, Gary, and that is, it seems to me that the one thing that Joe Biden proved the other night is that he has the energy and had the rehearsal time to really do well with his teleprompter.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of the favorable commentary about his remarks, and I guess when you set the bar so low that just getting through the hour is the mark of success, that he did that. But I really felt like it was an angry old man yelling at me for an hour.
Yeah.
If that kind of energy, if that kind of ability to yell everything he has to say means, gee, Joe has the energy, and Joe's not the dawdling old man that everybody's been saying he is, then I guess he hit the mark. But Bruce, the State of the Union address is an opportunity to unify people. A lot of people have pointed out it's probably the most partisan State of the Union address there's ever been. I don't know how many times he alluded to his predecessor. He wouldn't say Trump by name. But even Trump, I don't remember ever talking about his opponents at that kind of length in a State of the Union address. And the way he took on the Supreme Court, the way he treated the Supreme Court like it's just another legislative political branch of government was, I think, one of the most shameful moments in the address. So if you can't tell, I was not too impressed.
Okay. Let's ask Stephen Caliendo your reaction, Stephen, from your professorial position.
Well, I agree with Gary in terms of the bar being set low. I think that the question was how much energy was there going to be, and there certainly was the energy. You know, in terms of substance, there was a lot of policy in the speech, but there was also a lot of politics, and that's not unusual for presidential election year speeches by presidents who are running for re-election. So, not a lot of surprise there. I think one of the things that Joe Biden needed to do was to reach out to the left flank of his party. And he seemed to do that, particularly with respect to economics. And so it seems that some of the folks who are further on the left in the House in particular were energized by what he had to say. And that's going to be an important thing moving through, because unlike former President Trump, who's had an opportunity to try to unify members of his party, President Biden hasn't been going through any meaningful primary stage. And so this was an opportunity for him to do that.
And he slipped up on the illegal issue, but we'll get to that in a moment. Right. Judith Sherwin, you're a Republican. I suspect you didn't watch too much of it.
Well, actually, I kept tuning in and out of it, but I did watch some of it. It was the angriest state. I've never seen a State of the Union address like that. I mean, he started off comparing the situation to World War II and Hitler. I mean, really? So right there, he's alienated more than half of the country. I thought the most shameful moment, seriously, was what he did with the Supreme Court. And I don't know if you've seen a screenshot of what even the liberal justices looked pissed, okay? And it seems to me, you know, I'm a lawyer. If I have to go in front of a court, which Mr. Biden's going to have to do, or at least his cohort, Mr. Smith, is going to have to do soon, I wouldn't be insulting them. I wouldn't be telling them, you know, we're going to throw you out. You know, the women in this country have political power.
Power too, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what does that mean? They're not elected. What are you going to do to them? I mean, it was an absolutely shameful moment.
But do you acknowledge them? And maybe you won't acknowledge. There's a lot of people in this country don't like the Supreme Court. They don't like the recent decisions. And there's another possible portion of the country that didn't like previous decisions. Well, and my point is, these are people that are appointed for life.
Right.
They never have to answer any questions. They are above any interrogation. So what is so wrong if a political leader, this time being the President of the United States, or it could be a Republican, a couple of years ago, Obama did the same thing.
Yes, and it was wrong when he did it.
But the question is, why can't they take it? Why can't they take a little criticism from a political leader during the State of the Union address? They're big boys and girls.
This is a criticism.
But they have lifetime protection.
Not really.
What do you mean, not really? They have lifetime protection.
They could be impeached if somebody wanted to try to do that.
When's that going to happen?
We've also got people who are clamoring to do away with a third of the government. They are a third of the government. They are the part of the government who announces what the law is. You know, let me finish. Just this one point.
Okay? Sure.
The president, Joe Biden, or Donald Trump, whoever he may be, has Article II responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is to see that the law, as announced by the Supreme Court, is faithfully executed. That's something that Joe Biden hasn't done. That was totally gratuitous. The abortion decision happened 2 years ago. He got the benefit of that in the 2022 election. Okay, I'm sure he's going to get some more benefit out of it again. But that was not about abortion. That was being pissed off because of what they did on Monday.
Okay? Gary, where do you come down on this?
Well, as I mentioned, I also thought it was the most shameful moment of the speech.
But what is the point that I made, Gary? I mean, you and Judy agree on this, but what about the point of a lot of voters that would say, what's wrong with putting the Supreme Court, you know, basically on guard?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it, Bruce. This is supposed to be, everybody agrees that respect for the court has nosedived. And the problem, when the President of the United States treats the Supreme Court like it's just another legislative branch. This is part of the problem with how Democrats and liberals look at the courts, all courts, not just the Supreme Court. They think the courts are there to make policy. They think they're there to do a course correction rather than just interpret the Constitution. We need to build respect for the court in this country, not just the Supreme Court, but all courts. And when the president stands there and treats them like they're just another partisan legislative branch, it's not a matter of they can't take it. Sure, they can take it. It's a matter of what it does down the road to people respecting the decisions coming out of the Supreme Court.
Okay, we have heard those positions as well. 1-800-723-8289. Other issues. The president really slipped up when he referred to an illegal immigrant as an illegal. Back shortly from Chicago.
We can tell you about the incredible success we bring to local businesses, but it's better when it comes directly from our satisfied clients. Here's just one example.
After searching for a new vendor to handle my search marketing campaign, I contacted Salem Surround after seeing the great work they did for another restoration company in the different market. Their team of experts recommended a mix of multiple tactics designed to get my business the most quality leads at the lowest cost, making my marketing budget stretch further. In our first year partnering with Salem Surround, we recorded our best year to date, and I've told many people how blessed I was to find them. Their representative answered the phone every time I called and quickly addressed any questions or concerns I had.
Let Salem Surround give you an absolutely free audit of your current marketing and show you what your competition is doing. Then we can come up with a personalized plan that's perfect for your needs. Visit SurroundChicago.com and let our marketing experts help you achieve real success. Remember to visit SurroundChicago.com today.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hergaris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. As parents, we want our children to grow up healthy and strong. That means helping teens take responsibility for their health as they become young adults. One way to do that is to make sure they have one-on-one time with their pediatrician. That helps them become comfortable talking about any health issue with their doctors and with you. So make sure to give your teen a voice. It's good for their health. For more on teen health, visit healthychildren.org.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, and Stephen Maynard Caliendo wanted to respond to the previous conversation, so go ahead, Stephen.
Well, there's a great exchange, and I just what I wanted to point out was that I'll be looking forward to Judy and Gary being just as animated in their anger toward former President Trump when he goes after the U.S. Supreme Court in a couple of months when the immunity case comes down, because that certainly will not go his way, and it probably will be unanimous as well.
When it does,
he will go after them personally. Maybe not in a State of the Union address because he's not president. It will be hostile. And I'll be looking forward to hearing the same level of vitriol from my colleagues here about how inappropriate it is to attack the Supreme Court.
Gary first and then Judith. Gary, go ahead.
Oh.
Gary.
No, all I'm going to say is you'll hear that from me. And I've said that in the past. I've been very critical of how Trump attacks people and especially the courts. You've got to, you know, I'm sorry, Bruce, I've been on the show before with Bruce. He knows how I feel about the post-election stuff. He knows I'm not someone who buys into the fraud argument. This has been through the courts, and I think it's wrong for any president or ex-president to attack the courts. Now, do I think that a lot of these cases shouldn't exist? Yes, sure. But that's got to do more with the prosecutors than it's got to do with the court.
Right. Judith, final word to you, and then we're going to move on, but keep it short because I want a whole bunch of subjects to talk about.
Okay. Number one, when Trump attacks Judge Aragonon, I think his name is, he's got good reason to attack him. That's the worst judge I've ever seen in my life. Okay. No judge behaves like that judge behaved. That's number one. Number two, we have examples of Trump from his presidency. He had a number of decisions that went against him. Okay. He didn't vilify the court. He announced he didn't agree with them. That's something else. The point, though, is you can't do what Joe Biden did. If people don't have respect for the courts, we are going to be fighting each other with sticks and stones.
Okay.
That's the only thing that keeps us
Judith,
from doing it.
You've made the point several times, and I appreciate it, but we're going to move on because we've spent all this time talking about just one little piece of the president's comments the other night. But one of the other ones where everyone was expecting what was he going to say about illegal immigration. Again, he finally mentioned the name of Laken Riley, the young woman killed in Athens, Georgia, because he was prompted to do so by Marjorie Taylor Greene. So he held up the button that she gave him. He mispronounced the name. He said Lincoln instead of Laken. I mean, that's sort of a minor mistake. But in responding to that, he used the term, he referred to the perpetrator as illegal. And again, he took a lot of you-know-what from the progressives for that, so much so that he went on television the next day, and he apologized for using the word illegal. Now, from a political standpoint, it seems to me, I want to get Stephen's response to that first, because that, to a lot of people, if there were people on the fence about Joe Biden, that could have pushed him one way or the other. Your response.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Bruce. And I think, you know, it wasn't one of his finest moments in terms of if he would have been on script, he certainly wouldn't have used that language. It's not language that he typically uses. But then having to apologize for it, it gave the right an opportunity to suggest that he was apologizing for the actions of the person who committed the crime.
Isn't that typical language that the average American uses?
I don't think the typical average American refers to people as illegals.
Sure they do.
Yeah, they do. I hate to tell you something.
Well, they shouldn't. People cannot be illegal. Their actions can be illegal.
Presence here is illegal.
That's different than they're not illegal. That, right. They're, what they did.
Nobody's saying they're illegal.
When you call someone an illegal, that's a noun.
It's a shorthand way of referring to a person who has broken into the United States who does not.
Well, it's dangerous and dehumanizing here. And is problematic.
It's not dehumanizing, please.
Gary, if we get into a discussion of what the definition of illegal is Trump winning that argument or losing it in the body politic?
That's a great point, Bruce. He's winning that argument. And when Joe Biden, as Stephen points out, comes back and appears, you're right. It's not what he was doing. When he appears to be apologizing either for this alleged perpetrator or just for unfairly characterizing him, it seems like there's more sympathy there in that direction than for the victim. And so what does Trump do? He meets with the family of Lake and Riley, and he wins that argument. I do have to say, yes, where I live, the term illegal aliens or illegal immigrants is a very common way to describe people. And I think we're heading into some Orwellian territory where you can't describe that someone's here illegally and say those are illegal immigrants. Yeah, I'm not sure what it means to say people aren't illegal. They actually are if they're here illegally.
If you stole a candy bar when you were a child, to say you're a criminal, that's not accurate.
Nobody's saying that.
I understand.
Well,
Illegally is not comparable
to stealing a candy bar.
Absolutely.
From my childhood, which is a long time ago, I remember that January was the month that all illegal aliens were supposed to register with the government. The term illegal aliens was used by the government.
It's a legal term. It's in the statute.
Just a second. For decades. And that's the way they referred to. I guess once they figured that they weren't from Mars, they no longer called them aliens.
No, but that's what the statute calls them. Okay,
right.
They are illegal aliens. Okay, that's not saying they're not human. All it's saying is they are illegally present and they are alien to the country. And I agree with Gary.
When he's not on guard, it's what Joe Biden says too.
But I think that's probably right. We're falling into this Orwell stuff where we change the definition of everything because somebody comes up with some, you know, attenuated, my feelings are hurt. This got nothing to do with feelings.
Okay. Last word to Stephen, and then we're going to move on to another topic.
No, I think we're just going to agree to disagree on this. I think, you know, empathy is an important thing. I think kindness is an important thing, even to people who have broken the law. And so, I will not apologize for centering humanness. I think that's an important thing to do using our language.
Gary?
And I think it's wrong to say that if you refer to them as illegal immigrants, you don't have empathy. I have great empathy for a lot of people that come here for the reasons they come here. But again, that has nothing to do with the technical term that uses to describe who
their
they are when they illegally come into the country.
Right. No, their legal status has nothing to do with my empathy for the fact that they are here. But it does point out what their legal status is, which is that of an illegal alien, period.
By the way, when we talked earlier about the vigor of Joe Biden, and some people said that he was yelling, and he was yelling a little bit. People said it was like his grandfather saying, get off my lawn.
Right.
Some people have described it as that. I didn't see it as that initially. I can see in retrospect. But again, he came in, he looked energetic. I mean, he was late, 15 minutes late. when he got started, he was rolling. He was on a roll. Even I think the way he handled the Marjorie Taylor Greene interruption was okay. I mean, he got in political trouble because he used the word illegal, but I thought he handled that and stayed a long time getting selfies afterwards. So the vigor that the guy showed was, I think, clear to me. Very political, absolutely. I thought that I was listening to a speech at the DNC convention. Because that's what it was.
That's what
it was. It was a political rally, and the Democrats, obviously, in the House and Senate were responding to it.
Right. Absolutely agree.
I think that's right for the most part, too. I mean, you know, he did have mentioned some bills that were sitting before Congress that he urged them to pass, which is a typical thing to do in the State of the Union address. But it was much, you know, proportionally more political than most State of the Union addresses
have
been.
And he got into the point about how he views that it was the Republicans and Donald Trump, on orders from Donald Trump, that stopped the House negotiated bill. In the second hour this evening, let me mention, we are going to have a gentleman from Numbers USA. And I've asked him to be prepared to talk about the difference between H.R. 2, which is passed the House, then the Senate bill that did not make it, the Lankford compromise bill, and then now we got the new thing is the Laken-Riley bill, which passed the House a couple of days ago. So there's three pieces of legislation that are out there. In the second hour, we're going to go through and try to differentiate between all three of them, because I don't think the networks ever take the time to explain what all these debates are about. My next question is, one of the toughest jobs in politics is to be the person selected to respond to the State of the Union address. It's always a little awkward. But of all the Republicans that could have been picked, Judith Sherwin, what did you think of Senator Britt?
I thought it was absolutely awful. Okay, this is the Republican Party pretending they're going to be full of feeling and pander to the suburban housewife. I mean, to take this woman who is an accomplished politician and put her in the kitchen?
Agreed.
Okay, I mean, that was like the worst thing. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And the whole presentation, the way she went about it, it was awful. I mean, I understood that there was some movement to use Vivek to respond.
Yes.
That would have been a firehouse, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Nope, they go with this. I thought it was awful. It was embarrassing. And I understand that Mr. McConnell is the one who put his thumb on the scale for this. And quite frankly, he should resign right now. 8 more months of him sabotaging the Republican Party is really not something I want to see.
That's Stephen, your response.
Judy and I are exactly on the same page on this one. It was
I brought you together.
Especially the gender part of it. It was embarrassing. And I would just go a step further to say it's embarrassing that the Republican Party thinks that this is what suburban women want to hear. That's insulting.
I agree.
Right, exactly. So it was a shame. And, of course, the overdramatic sort of, you know, high school theater approach. That's not how she talks. She's very smart.
Yeah.
She's a very smart person.
She's a very accomplished person.
She's going to fall into the Bobby Jindal category, I have a feeling, here after this. It is
Gary, what's your response to it? We got 15 seconds.
A lot less concerned about it. I thought she was fine. I thought she was fine. She's trying to be pleasant. She's trying to soften the image of the Republican Party, and I thought she was fine.
Okay, back shortly from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
This is Carol Platt Liebau for townhall.com. Chief among Americans' complaints against President Biden's Justice Department has been selective prosecution. It seems those on the right are prosecuted for conduct the left engages in with impunity. One federal judge in California agreed. He's thrown out charges against right-wing rioters on the grounds of selective prosecution. The rioters attended a pro-Trump free speech rally in 2017. Leftist rioters, who attend such events to fight the right-wing groups, came primed for violence and attacked Trump supporters and police. The Biden Justice Department charged them under the Anti-Riot Act. Subsequently, the district court judge dismissed charges based on selective prosecution. He noted that the leftist groups instigated much of the violence and, by many accounts, behaved worse than the right-wing groups. But the Biden Justice Department has appealed. It seems their old habits die hard. One thing is clear. It's time for equal justice in America again.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We continue with Beyond the Beltway, and joining us on the air right now, we're going to ask three people to identify themselves. We're going to start with Gary Abernathy. Gary, tell everybody who you are and a little bit about your new book.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. I've been in journalism most of my career, the editor of three Ohio newspapers. I went into politics and worked for some members of Congress, for state party organizations, and then I spent the last 6 years writing for the Washington Post. They invited me to come on after Trump won the election in 2016 to kind of be a voice representing more of Trump country, which they didn't really mm-hmm. have at that time. So I've compiled a lot of those columns into a new book called MAGA Republicans Are Already Normal. I think it's called MAGA Republicans. If you hear, mm-hmm. Bruce, if you hear Joe Biden talk about how MAGA Republicans are threats to democracy, but I'll tell you,
you know,
if you
them.
Want to have fun, try writing a book called MAGA Republicans and watch the internet algorithms come alert, because one thing Biden has done well successfully is to turn the word MAGA into something apparently akin to something pretty bad. And the Amazon algorithms have just it took forever to finally get this placed. They still won't let me buy advertising on Amazon. It is available on Amazon, so get it while it lasts. MAGA Republicans Are Already Normal. And, of course, the title is a counter to what people say is, oh, you can't normalize Trump. You can't normalize
right.
MAGA followers. And my point is, MAGA Republicans are already normal. It's often the people who criticize them who are a little bit out of the mainstream.
Well, again, it was the national news media in the wake of Donald Trump's election that made that a bad word. I mean, they made it so yes. bad that you couldn't even wear a red hat, let alone a red MAGA hat. So they created a climate in the country that's horrible. But again, I just want to dig a little bit deeper on what I thought I heard you say. Are you saying that Amazon does not let you advertise the book because yeah. of its title?
It's my opinion it's because of the title. Now, they finally, after about 3 weeks, did put the book up for sale on its site. It is up for sale right now. But for some reason, a simple little ad, which is part of their advertising program, here, you want to publicize your book? Buy this ad.
Right.
It just says, Gary Abernathy's new book, yeah. MAGA Republicans, okay. is available now. That's all it says. They will not approve that ad. It's now been 3 weeks. The ad does not meet their standards. The ad is too political.
Oh, boy.
It's amazing to me how they can approve it for sale, but not approve it to be advertised. So, again, I'm convinced it's the MAGA word that's alerting all the bots and all the algorithms not to allow
it's
this
the,
to
It's unfortunately to the world we live in when it comes to the Internet.
Yeah.
Judith Sherwin, tell everybody who you are when you're not here.
When I'm not here, I'm a practicing lawyer in Chicago. I also teach at Loyola University Law School. When I teach in the law school, I teach constitutional law subjects, mostly in the First Amendment. And when I teach online through their non-lawyer master program, I teach ethics, business law, and compliance and regulatory stuff. So that's what I do.
Stephen Maynard Caliendo, tell everybody who you are.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me. I'm the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at North Central College in Naperville. I'm a political scientist by training, political psychologist, study political communication with an emphasis mostly on the United States and race, ethnicity, and politics. And I don't have a book out now, so I won't be competing with Gary on the Amazon list. But my fourth edition of my textbook on inequality in America will be out next year.
Just don't put MAGA in it.
I will not put. I've learned my lesson.
He now knows that.
I know that.
By the way, before the break, we talked a little bit about Senator Katie Britt of Alabama and how everybody seemed, with the exception of Gary. I would have weighed in on our guest in the studio that I thought she slipped and did not handle herself well, because more stylistically than anything else. But she is allegedly on a short list that Donald Trump is considering for a running mate. And I think she hurt herself very badly with the presentation. Not only, although Trump may have said he liked it, but
he did.
We'll see.
He did. He
but,
said he
you know,
liked
he
it.
He says that virtually about everybody that he likes, okay?
Yeah.
I want to enter another name that allegedly is being talked about. I don't know whether it's on a short list or not, but it's Nancy Mace, the veteran congresswoman from South Carolina. She was a guest this morning on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. If you saw it, I hope you agree with what I had to say, will say. And if you did not see it, you should look for it. We're going to play a little clip of it right now, but you may want to search it out to see the entire interview. It was the single best response by a conservative Republican to a liberal talk show host, journalist, that I've ever seen in the history of television. He was a pit bull. She was pit bull magnified. They went after each other for a whole segment. It was about 12 minutes. We're going to play a little clip of it now. We're going to dip in and out, and then I want to talk a little bit more about whether or not her demeanor, her ability to take on the national media, moves her name forward as a possible Donald Trump running mate. Let's watch.
Congressman, thanks for joining us this morning. And you've endorsed Donald Trump for president. Mm-hmm. Judges and two separate juries have found him liable for rape and for defaming the victim of that rape. How do you square your endorsement of Donald Trump with the testimony we just saw?
Well, I will tell you, I was raped at the age of 16. And any rape victim will tell you, I've lived for 30 years with an incredible amount of shame over being raped. I didn't come forward because of that judgment and shame that I felt. And it's a shame that you will never feel, George. And I'm not going to sit here on your show and be asked a question meant to shame me about another potential rape victim. I'm not gonna do that.
It's actually not about shaming you. It's a question about Donald
Trump. No, you
are
shaming me.
You've endorsed Donald Trump for president.
Right.
Donald Trump has been found liable for rape by a jury. Donald Trump has been found liable for defaming the victim of that rape by a jury. It's been affirmed by a judge.
It was not a criminal court case, number one. Number two, I live with shame. And you're asking me a question about my political choices, trying to shame me as a rape victim, and I find it disgusting. And quite frankly, E. Jean Carroll's comments when she did get the judgment, joking about what she was going to buy, it makes it harder for women to come forward when they make a mockery out of rape, when they joke about it.
Doesn't it make it harder for women to come forward when they
It makes it harder when other women
candidates.
Joke about it, and she's joked about it. I find it offensive. And I also find it offensive that you're trying to shame me with this question.
I'm not trying to shame you at all. In fact,
I have dealt with this for 30 years. You know how hard it was to tell my story?
They went on for quite some time, and he kept coming back with the same question. She kept coming back with the same answer, and later on, we pick it up a little bit, and we'll get a little bit more of this battle.
I said my piece on January 6th. I was very clear about how I felt about it. And I also, as you stated, I voted to certify the Electoral College for every single state in the country. But something's happened between now and then, and that was Joe Biden. And I listened to my voters. They move on. They don't ask me about January 6th. Maybe that's what you in the media, you guys talk about in your cocktail parties. But voters are not talking about it. They asked me about February 22nd, the day that Laken Riley was murdered by an illegal immigrant. They asked me about October 8th, the day that Maddie Hines, a South Carolina girl, 4-year-old girl, murdered by an illegal immigrant who was deported under Donald Trump and allowed back in under Joe Biden's administration. They're talking about the over 8 million illegals who've come across our southern border in an invasion of our country and an actual threat to democracy allowing that to happen. That's what they talk about.
Not talking about January 6th doesn't mean it didn't happen. You were very clear right there.
I just said that.
He should never hold office again. Because of what happened on January 6th, because of what he did on January 6th. You said he should be held accountable. How has he been held accountable?
Voters held him accountable through our Republican primaries this year. He's won overwhelmingly. America supports him. They're not looking back. They're looking forward. Since January 6th, we've had 3 years of Joe Biden. The American people do not like or support it. You've seen the polling. You cited the polling in your show today showing that Trump is beating Joe Biden on all of the critical issues that the American people care about, talking about immigration, the border, inflation, et cetera. He's very strong.
That was Nancy Mace. Gary, you did not watch it as it happened, but as you listened to it and as you heard this clip, what was your reaction to the way she handled herself?
Well, you know, Bruce, when I talk to college groups or I talk to students or I talk to folks who try to understand, you know, Trump and his supporters and so on, one thing I make sure to spell out for them is that for most Republicans today, especially Trump followers, the main enemies they don't see as the Democratic Party. They see the main enemy as the mainstream media. So anytime, right or wrong, I'm just saying this is who they identify as their top enemy is the media above the Democratic Party, above the Biden campaign. And so anytime a Republican is willing to just kind of take on the media, rightfully or wrongly, justifiably or not, they're going to score points with that base. They're going to score big points with that, you know, Trump following base because they like it when politicians stand up and shoot back at mainstream media types like George Stephanopoulos.
Stephen Maynard Galeando, your reaction?
Yeah, I agree with Gary on the media part of it. It's easy. It's low hanging fruit to go after media folks, especially if you're center right. And I think I think that George Stephanopoulos ought to know better. As a man, he should never have asked that question. He should know better. He's been doing this a long time, not just journalism, but he was in politics before that. And Nancy Mace had every right to be indignant. What undermined her indignant nature, though, however, is when she tried to shame Eugene Carroll in the same statement. It was really problematic. It's that she was right that asking that question was designed to shame her in some way. And then she turned around and said, well, but there's a person who is a rape victim that I don't like, and I think she's disgraceful. That part to me was problematic.
Judith.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with that because
We've got to come back. Okay. Music is a play, and I want to get your basic reaction to that debate today between George Stephanopoulos and Nancy Mace. And I'd love to hear from anybody who thinks that I may be right, that this was a giant step forward to her possibly being picked as her running mate, where she could go out and be a pit bull with the media during the campaign and defend Donald Trump. Back shortly.
This is Dennis Prager. Sign up today for an unforgettable experience in Israel this October. Mike Gallagher and I are traveling to the Holy Land on the Stand with Israel tour with our trusted partner, Inspiration Cruises and Tours. This trip of a lifetime to Israel is one you don't want to miss. Register today before it's too late at StandWithIsraelTour.com, StandWithIsraelTour.com, or call 855-565-5519, 855-565-5519.
You're smart, you're busy, and don't have time to waste on the mainstream media cycle. Salem News Channel breaks that cycle. Topics that matter from hosts worth watching. Dinesh D'Souza, Andrew Wilkow, Brandon Tatum, and more. Open debate and free speech you won't find anywhere else. Salem News Channel, not like the other guys. Watch anytime on any screen, free 24/7.
Find everything you need to know at snc.tv. That's snc.tv.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school? Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if the music stopped? If the familiar voices were silenced? If there were no breaking news updates? What if your companion and connection to your community came with a monthly fee? Don't worry, we're free local radio with you wherever you go. Celebrating 100 years and looking forward to the next 100. We are broadcasters. Text radio to 52886 and let Congress know you depend on your local TV and radio stations. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, and Judith Sherwin. People were standing by around the country. They put down all their focus on what you want to say.
On what so I want ahead. To say. Okay.
We're talking about Nancy Mace, her comments today with George Stephanopoulos.
I do remember. I'm not Joe Biden, but okay.
I know.
In any event, here's the thing. I thought that George Stephanopoulos was maybe one of the worst exchanges I ever heard. He was trying to shame her, absolutely, on the basis of the fact that she had been raped. So how could you possibly be a supporter of Donald Trump? Okay. I mean, she
put him away. It was a gotcha question.
It was a gotcha question.
And every media person has gotcha questions.
And he wouldn't stop. No. I mean, he should have stopped after the first question, but he wouldn't stop. And he kept going. So, good for her. She really put him away, and she should put him away, and he should hide his head in shame. The part that I thought was really interesting was the rest of the discussion, the second clip that you played. This is a woman who did have some very harsh things to say about Donald Trump after January 6th. There's a lot of interesting information that's come out about January 6th in the last 3 years. I don't want to get into that discussion now.
Thank
but
you.
But I thought her responses and her analysis and the way she put him down on the rest of that stuff was terrific. Now, is that going to make her a running mate? I have no idea. But I was extremely impressed with her. I thought she was very, very good. And I think George Stephanopoulos I can't say on the air what I think he is.
But as a woman from South Carolina, and as a woman who, as you say, has been critical of Donald Trump in the past, and 6 months from now or ago, she would not have been on any short list for anything.
No.
She had not made the big switch to be a supporter of
Donald
Trump.
I think she was a
Donald
supporter
Trump.
Of Nikki Haley, actually. I'm not sure.
I don't know whether that came out that way. But what I'm saying is, if she were to be picked, not only because she is a woman, but she is a woman that frankly disliked Donald Trump for a lot of the reasons that a lot of the Nikki Haley women dislike Donald Trump.
Right.
And she might be able to, answer that question. I want to get Stephen's response and Gary's response.
I'd like to have one little response on that too.
Yeah, no, I don't have much to add there. I think that's right. I mean, you know, there's the short list hasn't been made public. It's mostly rumor and innuendo less than innuendo at this point about who he might pick. I don't know. I mean, it was clear to me during the debates, at least, that Vivek Ramaswamy was running for the position of vice president. But I don't know whether or not that he would be an attractive choice, other than the fact that he has a lot of money. That he seems very willing to spend, and President Trump needs a lot of money.
But he has told Donald Trump, as has Elon Musk, we're not going to send money to you.
Yeah.
Vivek made that comment. Back to you, Gary, from Vivek's home state of Ohio. What's your reaction on on this part of our discussion?
Yeah. Well, again, I agree. She scored a lot of points she elevated her status for sure. But in terms of the VP sweepstakes, my money is still on Tim Scott. I think Trump will go with Tim Scott for a number of reasons. I think he loves the guy personally. He likes Senator Scott's very adamant support of him, very vociferous support. As Trump says, he does a better job campaigning for Trump than he did for himself.
Right.
And I think that we'll see how it turns out, but my money's still going to be on Tim Scott for that VP slot.
Your reaction, Stephen?
Yeah, I think I don't know about whether I'd be a betting person, but that certainly would be in the top a couple of names for me too.
Tim Scott for you?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think Trump likes him. Okay, and I think he's learned from the first time around, and he's not going to take somebody that he doesn't know well, that he's not comfortable with, or that has to have sold to him. He likes.
He's going to look for someone more loyal.
It's not loyal. It's somebody he likes. No, it's somebody he likes.
But, but I think it's loyal.
Somebody he's going to have to go.
Because he only likes people until they don't like him. So it is loyalty.
No, it's not loyalty. It's not loyalty.
Gary,
you don't want to go to war with somebody who you don't like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And he knows if he gets back into the White House, he's going to war.
Back to Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
Mike Pence was the most loyal vice president you could ever have. Mike Pence took that VP slot at the cost of his own reputation, was willing to do that, brought evangelicals with him. They stuck with Trump. Pence did the only thing he could do on January 6th, and he did the right thing. So whenever people, go after Mike Pence like he wasn't loyal somehow, I'm like, where did you have amnesia during the whole 4 years of Trump's presidency?
Yeah.
Pence was Trump's best advocate, especially in that debate with Kamala Harris in the campaign.
He never said he wasn't loyal. Okay.
Well, I'm just.
I don't know that he was.
Why didn't say you said that?
Yeah. Okay. Good.
In this particular case, let me just say though that I think the selection of Tim Scott, it may help him with some black voters. There's evidence out there that some black voters are moving towards Trump. It may help a little bit with the African American voter. I don't think a lot. It isn't going to help him carry South Carolina because he's always going to do that.
Right.
I think where the selection of Tim Scott helps is with suburban Republican women.
I think that's probably true. But I think Trump's position with the black community is being helped by his situation. Okay.
Yes.
The black community has a very different view of Donald Trump. Well, first of all, they always had a good view of him. He was the subject of rap songs. I mean, they had to be convinced that he was a racist, right? I think they're coming back from that a little bit. And there's a recent poll that shows him with 25% support in the black community. If he has 25% support in the black community, the election's over.
Okay. I agree with that. Gary, thank you very much for joining us, and give us one more swipe at that book for people that can't find it on Amazon.
MAGA Republicans are already normal, and other shocking notions available. Get it while you can on Amazon. Bruce, thank you for letting me do that, and thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. That's a compilation of your many distinguished columns over the years, writing for the Washington Post and for newspapers around the United States. Hour number one is over. Stay right here. Our guests will stay here. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking about illegal immigration, legal immigration, and what can be done to either support it or to shoot it down. Back short. Don't go away. Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Stephen Maynard Caliendo joins me in studio, as well as Judith Sherwin. They represent different points of view on the political spectrum. And we are now joined by Michael Massa, and he is the president of Numbers USA. And Michael, nice to have you with us on our program this evening. And I want to begin by talking about the variety of pieces of legislation that are out there, some passed, some not passed by both houses. And I want to get your assessment, because this is your professional issue. Which of the bills that's out there right now is the best bill for what you want to happen in the country?
Well, again, Numbers USA has been looking at immigration as our sole issue for 27 years.
Right.
And speaking of the bills that are available today, the House of Representatives passed a bill called H.R. 2 back in May, and it was called the Secure the Border Act. That bill will resolve the border issues we face today, which is this unprecedented surge of people coming across our border illegally.
In what way?
So that's what I would say is the number one bill.
Or in what way would it do that?
Well, there's actually almost 13 or 14 parts of it, but I would focus on four areas. One is it reforms the parole process so that the individuals who are coming in and seeking parole are evaluated on an individual basis, which is the current law. And it also ensures that the standard for asylum, which is another aspect of people who come across the border today looking for entry into the United States, that the standard is such that they would be properly vetted so that they are truly being persecuted in their country. That's again the current standard in the law, that they have to be persecuted in their country for one of the reasons that we wouldn't have, you know, race, creed, etc. But not that they have a bad economic situation or that it's a bad government situation. I mean, those are terrible situations, of course, but those aren't really the valid reasons for asylum. So parole and asylum would both be reformed. We would have a reinstatement of a stay in Mexico policy, which is basically that people who are to come in the United States have to stay in Mexico or in their country of origin until their request for asylum or parole is adjudicated. And the last thing,
let me follow up on just that third point, and then we can go to the fourth point as well.
Sure.
But the remain in Mexico, which is a frequently thrown around term, I think I know what that means. But how was that negotiated? What does Mexico get from the United States for allowing us to keep migrants in Mexico while we adjudicate their cases? What are they getting out of this?
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's a diplomatic relationship. And what it is that we have a positive and fair open trade relationship with them. And this can take many different forms. It takes not resisting things where they are placing new factories in their country to be able to move workers out of the United States or from other countries into the Mexico. It also includes being able to allow us to ensure that when we do have people go across, come into the border, they return, that we will properly and quickly adjudicate those cases, but we won't do it in a way where we're having them stay inside of our country. So what they receive out of it is a fast process. What mm-hmm. we receive out of it is the ability to make sure that the process is done without the people being released into the United States.
And when remain in Mexico was being administered by the Trump administration, how significant were the administrators and the judges? How many did we have that were working on adjudicating those cases?
Well, you know, I don't have the exact number that I can rattle off at the moment. The number of them was adequate for the flow. Because what occurs is this. Once people realize that when they come to the United States, cross over illegally, that they're not going to be released into the United States with a job permit, then they stop coming over. The surge we have, which now has over 300,000 people coming across the border illegally every month, was much, much, much less because their prospects of being able to get in the United States and get released was much, much less. So it has a deterrent capability just in and of itself that they have to stay outside of our country. The current law in Title VIII, which is the Immigration Naturalization Act, actually states that they need to be detained or they need to be returned immediately to their country of origin or to Mexico, or a third safe country next to us.
Right. Give us the fourth point that you were going to make about the legislation.
Well, the fourth point actually ties into the Lake and Riley Act, which was passed also in the House, but it has to do with state standing. In H.R. 2, it gives the states and the attorney generals of those states standing to be able to hold the federal government accountable to implement the immigration laws that Congress has passed. And if those states are negatively impacted because those laws are not being enforced, then they can essentially sue the federal government to enforce those laws. Currently, when states attempt to do this, the Supreme Court has ruled that they don't have standing. And so the fourth pillar in the H.R. 2 is the ability to have states and the attorneys general of those states have standing so that they can basically demand that the federal government enforce the laws that Congress has enacted.
Mm-hmm. And on H.R. 2, how much additional appropriations, how much more money do they get to enforce H.R. 2?
In H.R. 2, there is some additional funding for additional Border Patrol. There is some additional funding for others, but it's not just funding that's important. What's most important in the H.R. 2 is the closing of loopholes and the ability to ensure that the federal government enforces the current laws that are in place. Just having more money available is only allowing more processing of illegal entries to be able to be to occur more quickly.
Right.
And what we know is those people who are applying for asylum, over 95% of them, if they do show up for their asylum cases, are not allowed into the country. They do not qualify when the adjudication finally occurs. But what we've done is created a situation, the Biden administration has, where they use a loophole to allow people to come in, they give them parole, they allow them to have a job, and then it takes years to be able to process them. So the idea of just putting more money behind it is really not the solution that's necessary. More money would help. Yes, more Border Patrol helps. Yes, more barrier helps. But what really helps is the will to enact the current law.
Did the H.R. 2, did that provide any passes for job permits? Was that included in H.R. 2?
Ask the question again. I'm not certain what you asked.
The ability to work in the United States, the permits to work in the United States, was any of that included in H.R. 2?
Well, the ability to work in the United States exists in the current law. And the ability to even give someone parole for humanitarian reasons. You know, humanitarian reasons in the law and in H.R. 2 are further defined as things like, you know, you need to get in for medical treatment. You need to get in to attend the funeral of a relative. You mm-hmm. need to get in to actually attend your adjudication case. Those are humanitarian reasons that would have you come in under parole for a very short period of time. Okay. Now, you can receive parole and you can receive a job permit or a job authorization under the current law. So there's no need to increase that mm-hmm. in H.R. 2. What the intention of H.R. 2 is to make sure that it's only done on a case-by-case basis, not in a countrywide basis, and it's done when the proper humanitarian requirements are met.
When we come back, I want to talk about the bill that didn't quite make it in the Senate, and I want to talk about the new Lincoln Riley law, what that brings to the table. That's also passed by the House. We will do that when we continue on Beyond the Beltway.
As a local business owner, you get called every week by marketing companies. We get it. We have hundreds of satisfied customers. Here's what a satisfied client recently said.
Open enrollment is going great. We're hitting record numbers. Thank you so much for this report. It really is amazing to see how the marketing is really shaping our enrollment around the city.
If you're a local business and ready for the next step, visit SurroundChicago.com right now. Our experts are ready to help you take your marketing to the next level. Visit SurroundChicago.com today.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vody Bauckham examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide, available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Along with Stephen Maynard, Caliendo, and Judith Sherwin, I'm Bruce Dumont. We continue talking with Michael Massa from Numbers USA. And Michael, before we get to the bill about the Senate, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Lake and Riley bill that passed the House. This was after just a couple of days ago. What does that do what does that do?
Well, first off, just a little correction for you. My staff must have given you the wrong name. It's James Massa, just for the record. So
I'm sorry. Well, we're gonna change that, and I stand or sit corrected. So James, go ahead.
My apologies. Probably on our side. No. So listen, the Lake and Riley Act. What it does is, again, under specific circumstances, give states' attorneys the ability to sue the federal government and to hold them accountable to enforce the law. So laws that were not enforced that resulted in the unfortunate death of Lake and Riley include such things as having someone in the country who was not vetted, released illegally. They came in on what is a class of parole that has to do with an entire nation, Venezuela, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Honduras. Those four nations are allowed to bring 30,000 people into the United States every month. And they're doing it under the prospect of parole, and but it's supposed to be done on an individual case-by-case basis. So that's not being done. This would allow the states to sue the federal government and actually have injunctions so that practice would have to stop immediately and would be enforced by the courts. So that's really the biggest power of Lake and Riley Act, is that it gives the states the ability to ensure that when there's violations of the law, that they can sue the federal government, they can seek injunctive relief, and they can ensure that the law is then enforced going forward.
Does any legislation that's out there, does anything specifically refer to remain in Mexico and we're going to abolish that policy? Is there anything that's that simple and succinct to follow?
Inside the Lake and Riley Act, it is not. Okay. Inside H.R. 2, it ensures that the policies that which we call remain in Mexico are indeed put in place, so that a person who comes into the nation and seeking asylum or seeking parole during their adjudication period are either detained in accordance to the law today, or they're returned to either Mexico could be Canada as well, honestly, or the country of origin from which they're coming from.
Judith Sherwin joins us. She's got a question or comment for you.
Yeah, I was wondering what you think of this new, I don't know if it's a policy or what it is, where administration is taking people directly from places like Venezuela and flying them to various parts of the United States.
Well, it's a good question. You know, one of the things that the Biden administration is attempting to do more than anything else is not stop the flow of people coming across the border illegally, but trying to change the optics of it. So you don't want these large crowds down on the southern border. In order to do that, they've set up these provisions that allow people to fly directly into the interior. Everyone's all concerned about Texas or Florida sending people up from their states to the various areas. But the largest transporter of illegal aliens, that's the legal term, into the United States, these people who are outside the United States coming in and don't have legal lawful presence, is the United States government. They're handing them over to NGOs to bus to various cities, or they fly them directly into cities. So like when Denver, which has an enormous problem with its budget now, over $100 million deficit, unable to provide social services and other healthcare services to their citizens, looks at what the problem is. They have over 40,000 illegal aliens present, and of the vast majority of them are from Venezuela. So you'd say, why would all the Venezuelans go to Colorado? It's because they can fly directly into Denver.
Right.
You see the same problem in Salt Lake City, where we have similar problems there, and other people trying to work with them, but the vast majority of people who are there who are illegal aliens are there, and they're Venezuelan. So you see that this grouping of allowing a whole nation to be able to send people across directly into our interior is directly impacting these interior cities. So we're strongly against it. We think it's an abuse of the parole system.
I think it's a violation. Sounds like a violation.
Also,
a violation of the law. I mean, they just send them over. Nobody knows where they're going. I mean, you know, there's a group in Denver, but the destinations for these people is something that's being withheld on the basis of national security, which is something I don't understand at all.
But I want to go to Stephen Maynard de Caliendo, get him into the conversation. Your comments or questions for James Massa.
Yeah, James, we got James's name right now. That's good. James, thanks so much for all the information. I think especially helping us understand the differences between these various bills and how they mesh with the current laws. There's been a lot of political talk, of course, about what happened with H.R. 2 and why, no matter how much work the Republicans put in on it, it's not coming to the floor for a vote. Do you see any way that it's coming, number one? And then number two, what's the alternative? I mean, is it I think the Republican plan seems to be to wait to see if they can win in November and then have more legislative success then come next January.
Well, that's a handful of questions. Let me see if I can make a few comments on your points. The H.R. 2 has an opportunity to become law still this Congress, particularly as we come up against either funding the government mm-hmm. or funding supplemental budget requests such as Ukraine funding. Those two things are the area where it looks like the House is going to try to make a stand and, with their power of the purse, withhold funding for other important things until the border is secured. The border mm-hmm. being secured through H.R. 2, the Secure the Border Act.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the
mm-hmm.
challenge that the Republican Party has is that any party which has typically been involved with an issue that shuts down the government ends up being penalized in the polls later on. But because the border issue is so visible to the public today, with over 75% of all people, regardless of their ideological and political preferences, wanting to have a change in the border, wanting the border to surge to be stopped, we think that it is a viable option for the House to be able to say, no, we're not going to fund DHS or other parts of the government, Department of Homeland Security, which has the majority of the budget related to immigration, to be able to not fund those parts of the government until the Secure the Border Act is actually amended and brought as part of that bill.
Well, my question, James, can they do
funding, and that's really up to the House.
Can they do that without running afoul of the former president?
Well, H.R. 2 is the bill that was passed in the House.
Right.
By the
Republicans. Let's let James
yeah,
respond to that.
Senate bill is the one
that they, that's true.
But that's a good question, because if the House passes something,
right,
it raises the level of the discussion, and basically it sends it to the Senate to say, you know, put up or shut up.
Right.
But what does that do to Donald Trump? Does he put up or shut up at that particular point?
That's
that he's
question.
Got one half. He's got one half of Congress that basically
Trump
agrees with him. Go ahead.
Former President Trump and now President for the Republican Party, presumptive nominee. There's a lot of titles there. But he did a fine job of identifying the problem. He never brought into law during his first 2 years before the pandemic the types of laws that were necessary to ensure that immigration remained low as it did during his presidency. As he comes into an opportunity now, there's a lot of thought that he is the one that's been driving the issues with the Senate bill. But the Senate bill, to speak about it, was not a bill that anyone was supporting. I mean, you need 51 votes to be able to even bring it to consideration for discussion. That's called passing cloture. Mm-hmm. And it couldn't even get 51 votes. Now, the Senate is majority controlled by the Democrats today. So it wasn't a good bill. There's a lot of talk about it being a compromise bill. There was nothing in that bill that had to do with H.R. 2.
Right.
There was nothing in that bill that reflected something like Laken Riley's Act. And so it was a bill that actually increased immigration legally, and it also codified into the law that even though the president would be trying to close the border as the power he was saying it gave him to do, he would be required, and any future president would be required, to allow 1,500 people who would be illegal aliens into the country every single day. It was 550,000 illegal aliens being codified into the law. It's like a whole nother set of immigration that was occurring.
James,
Congress hadn't approved.
So my question is,
if
H.R. 2 moves to the Senate, former President Trump says, pass it. Even if the Biden administration gets credit for the win.
He doesn't care. He wants to secure the border, period.
Okay.
I don't think that's what he wants.
Then you're not paying attention.
Okay. Other than Senator Lankford, who were the other Republicans that were part of this negotiating team? Because the president always says bipartisan. Was it more than just Lankford? How many other people were involved, and who were they?
There was three who were identified. It was Senator Lankford, who was the Republican,
right.
Senator Sinema, who was independent, and Senator, the name's escaping me, who was a Democrat, but who was really driving that bill was Senator McConnell.
Right.
I strongly believe the reason you see that Senator McConnell is stepping down now is that his failure to be able to work behind the scenes on that bill is just one of the indicators that he's kind of lost his control inside the party that he represents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's never been a strong immigration security person. He's always been a strong hawk on military issues. And so this was really all about Ukraine funding and trying to do something that would have immigration in there. But he had he was behind the scenes. His people were involved in the negotiations. And when he finally voted against it, it was kind of indicative of what he did with what was recalled the Gang of Eight, which was a bill he supported in the past. Which
James,
was a huge amnesty
we got to pause. When we come back, I want to talk more about the Senate bill. Delve into that and also take more questions at 1-800-723-8289.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Voddie Baucham examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
Feel like you're trying to push a boulder uphill wearing skates? If you run or manage a local business today, you're challenged like never before. We get it, and we want to help. We're Salem Surround. We're a full-service marketing agency that'll help you increase your customer base by designing incredibly effective plans to reach your consumers day, night, and everywhere they might be.
If you're a local business and want to see what Salem Surround can do for you, visit surroundchicago.com. Remember to visit surroundchicago.com today.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We continue with Beyond the Beltway, and we reach out now to the great state of Washington, where Dave is listening tonight. He's got a question for everybody. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey there. Thanks. It's about HR 2 and sort of an overall thing. One quick review I'd like to give for some people, especially in mainstream media, is Trump was trying to pass more comprehensive immigration reform when he was in office, and the Democrats were steadfast against it, especially because of the funding for the border wall, which now apparently everybody's coming back around. The wall is okay, maybe, and they seem to like walls around the Senate and the House. But anyway, this HR 2, it was remarked that when it gets to the Senate's controlled by the Democrats. But I'd like to remind people or put out there that Sinema is now an independent.
Right.
She's still there. And Manchin, who has been what you could call double-crossed by the Democrat Party on some of his votes that he was persuaded to vote, both of them could feasibly vote for this HR 2. And I think Trump and all of the politicians that go on, you know, in the interview shows need to hammer every time they're on there, okay, put HR 2 up, and I support HR 2. Put it to the Senate, get a vote on it, and let's see where the chips fall. And that way, if it is passed, Trump's already said, yeah, I was supporting that. I pushed him to do it, and they did it. He actually could get credit for it, and it would be good for everybody because the wall, it would get passed.
Right.
And also, frankly, Democrats in tight races could vote for it, and they would probably increase their chances of being elected.
Yes.
In some cases. James, your reaction to this idea from Dave?
Well, I think it's a good idea. There's a lot of political dynamics that occur logistically in the Senate. One is that it has to be brought to the floor, and that's controlled by the president of the Senate. And so it can't just be voted on. There is one way that can be done. It's called suspending the rule. It requires two-thirds of the Senate to say they want to vote on something anyway. I mean, Senator Cruz has already announced a companion bill to H.R. 2 to the Senate, right, but it just hasn't been allowed to come to the floor to be voted on. Another way around it, which might be something that comes up, is that a funding bill, this is called appropriations, when those are voted on, they have to originate in the House, which is what's occurring right now, and when they get passed over to the Senate, they only need a majority, a simple majority of the Senate to approve those bills, not 60 votes, 51 votes. And so it is possible that they amend an appropriations bill and place H.R. 2 as part of it and then pass that over to the Senate, that a simple 51 votes could bring it forward as well.
Yeah, they did that a couple of times during Trump.
On that yet.
They did that.
I'm sorry?
They did that a couple of times in the last few years with these appropriations bills. That dealt with all kinds of things.
It's a different world and a very important world.
Right.
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 Let's go back to the Senate compromise bill, which Donald Trump does not like, and members of the Republicans in the Senate, they have said that they're not voting for it, basically because of Donald Trump, or they find things about it that they don't like. But the media and the Democrats, especially the media, have hammered the Republicans on the fact that Donald Trump is standing in the way of real, at least as they see it, real immigration reform. I think you could easily see through those charges, but again, those charges are literally hammered and shoved down the throat of every Republican who is on the air trying to defend it. But my question is the 1,500 per person daily requirement, that threshold, is that a piece of the legislation that could be amended? And if by you amending that, would the deal go through if you could get rid of that or renegotiate that $1,500 figure, 1,500 person figure that everyone seems to be throwing around? I hear the term, by the way, 5,000. The term I've heard.
The trigger for enacting the closing of the border is 5,000 a day for 7 days, or
right,
8,500 right. in a single day.
Right.
But the requirement, even under those circumstances, was to still process 1,500 a day.
Anyway.
So that was one of those. That was the actual language of the bill.
Right.
Let me just state that, regardless of what the Democratic Party and then President Biden wants to say about President Trump, he is not why the Senate bill was not passed. It isn't his authority that came in. It wasn't his pressure on the senators. It was a bad bill. It was a bad bill that even the Democrats wouldn't put past for discussion. It didn't receive enough votes to even go into discussion because it had a raising of the legal limit, and it had this description of what we just said about, you know, codifying the 1,500 a day. So I don't think there's any way you're going to modify that bill so that it comes back. It wasn't a compromise bill. It had nothing that included the H.R. 2 Secure the Border Act clauses. And so it's just not something that it's being painted as this great compromise bill, and that Trump shot it down. And neither of those things is true. It was bad mm-hmm. legislation, and I don't think it has any chance to come back.
Right. Also, you mentioned that one of the co-sponsors or one of the lead negotiators was Kyrsten Sinema. She is now retiring from the Senate, or is not going to seek re-election. And the other Democrat, I think you couldn't remember, was Senator Murphy of Connecticut. I think he was
Murphy.
The person,
yes, I apologize for that.
That's okay. Yeah. Let's go to Ben, who's listening to us on KTSM in El Paso, Texas. You've seen a migrant or two in your backyard, haven't you, Ben?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay,
definitely. I wanted to ask your guest, how many people are we supposed to be letting in from Venezuela?
We
mentioned that a little earlier.
We're allowed to let up to 30,000 people every month in from four countries: Venezuela, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Honduras. And so it's a combination of them for those four.
For a total of 30.
Have you ever heard of Trinidad-Aragua? Have you ever heard of the cartel called Trinidad-Aragua?
I have not.
Tell us about it.
Okay. Basically, it's a cartel that's based out of Venezuela. And they're now in something like 10 countries on this side of the earth. And they're operating in New York City. They're doing the bidding of both the Venezuelan government and the Iranian government. And they've been a lot of people say that they are worse than MS-13. And
but they're a gang.
Being allowed in
they're a gang.
Yes.
So there's a gang again for those listening around the country. I know in many jurisdictions, and even in Chicago, there's been investigation and some, I think, arrests of those who were associated allegedly with that gang, who are involved in the smash and grab robberies that we see throughout the city of Chicago and throughout the country. That is now one of the at least one of the main things that the that are involved in this that that lead to street crime in the United States. And that is another issue that I think we're going to see and hear a lot more about that, because whereas a horrible murder of a college student or a young woman in Georgia is a horrendous story, the story that most people, at least in Chicago, and I think many large cities in the United States, the story that they see every single night on the television are smash and grab robberies that are that they're dismissed by the local state's attorney. And the fact that, or the speculation that some of those are tied to Venezuelan, you know, cartels, and that Venezuela is really, they're importing their criminality to the United States. I think that's a political explosive bomb waiting to explode. Professor, do you share that concern? And I want to get everybody's reaction to that.
I think that, you know, anytime you have good video, that is dramatic video to show in a campaign ad, on newscasts, et cetera, it's going to be effective, especially as it evokes strong emotion, including fear. And of course, you know, contemporary times are not new using fear in political campaigns. But people very far away from urban centers have expressed fear of this sort of activity because the images are frightening. And so I think we'll see much more of that in the next 8 months for sure.
Do we know or can you comfortably speak about how these images either are being viewed or might be viewed by the Mexican and Hispanic communities in the Chicagoland area?
I can't speak with a lot of authority, but I can just tell you in terms of survey data that we have had for many, many years about Hispanic Americans and their ideas. And so when we're talking about potential voters, we're talking about U.S. citizens, right? Mm-hmm, so Hispanic American voters. And of course, it's not a monolithic group. You know, we know that the folks in Florida, which have Cuban ancestry, is different than folks in other parts of the country. But that very often the mentality is that we came the right way. These folks are not. And so the solidarity that you might expect because there's a common heritage doesn't always hold firm. But the rhetoric, I mean, the rhetoric, if there's dehumanizing rhetoric, that undermines that. And so, again, I think the thought about how we approach the conversation matters a lot. But in terms of the policies, you know, we can't make sweeping judgments about how Hispanic Americans will respond.
One other follow-up question.
Could I say something?
Not right now. Okay. One of the follow-up questions that I have is that African Americans, the crime in the African American community, according to police officials, it's difficult to solve that crime because a large number of people in the African American community do not cooperate with the police. They see nothing. They can't remember anything. And my question is, and you can give this answer after the break as well, and we'll hear from Judith. But my question is, within the Hispanic community, there's also crime in those communities. Do we know whether they are more or less likely to report crime than the rest of the members of their community? That's your question to you. Judith, I can't even imagine what's going to come out of your mouth. And James Massa continues with us as well from Washington, D.C. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us on Beyond the Beltway.
Feel like you're trying to push a boulder uphill wearing skates? If you run or manage a local business today, you're challenged like never before. We get it, and we want to help. We're Salem Surround. We're a full-service marketing agency that'll help you increase your customer base by designing incredibly effective plans to reach your consumers day, night, and everywhere they might be.
If you're a local business and want to see what Salem Surround can do for you, visit surroundchicago.com. Remember to visit surroundchicago.com today.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Back. We have one more segment to go. Judith Sherwin, you wanted to make a point, and then I want to go back to James Massa.
Yeah, the point I want to make is that the Hispanic community, I do not think, looks at this as the Republicans are bad. And in particular, they don't look at this immigration issue. I agree. They say, I came here legally. I want you to come here legally. You know, why should you jump the line? Donald Trump, speaking of which, has made tremendous inroads in the Hispanic community, and according to many polls, is now leading by a significant amount in the Hispanic community in the idea of who's going to be the next president. So I think the Hispanic community is not of a mind to think that they're being picked on because the immigration policy with respect to illegal immigration, you know, is so front and center.
I want to go back to the question I asked before the break of Stephen. And Stephen, my question again, to repeat it, is the ability and the willingness of the Hispanic communities, and there are many Hispanic communities, as you mentioned, in large cities and around the United States, do they tend to cooperate with fighting crime in their neighborhoods? Because it is said that African Americans do not. And it's why African American crime on African Americans is rarely ever solved. But do the Hispanics feel the same way, or are they fearful of stepping forward and putting their name on a list or engaging with the authorities, thinking that that will come back and bite them in the butt someday?
Well, so now we're talking about Hispanics generally, not U.S. citizens who are Hispanic descent, right?
Right?
What we know is that when there are sanctuary cities, crime will be reported by Hispanics. That reporting of violent crime goes down considerably in areas where there's not sanctuary because there's fear of deportation. So that's one of the arguments for sanctuary cities, is that it allows crimes to be solved more readily.
James, your reaction to that. We haven't spoken too much about sanctuary cities, and I know that the sanctuary city movement is on the opposite side of the political spectrum than Numbers USA, but take a moment to share your thoughts about how bad sanctuary cities represent the country.
Well, I would say that first that one of our executives, Jim Robb, has written a book recently called Political Migrants, Hispanic Voters on the Move. And this was done after the polling of voters after the last midterm elections. And we found that, as you have said, that most of the Hispanic voters are in favor of strong immigration law. Well, those are U.S. citizens because they're able to vote. And they want to make sure that the immigration laws are followed because they followed them when they came in the United States. And we need to also be aware that 60% of the people coming across the southern border today are not from Latin America. They're not from Central America. They're not from South America. They're from other countries in other continents, over 60%. So, again, the immigration that's occurring in the surge on the border is not just a Hispanic situation at all. As for sanctuary cities, we do find that sanctuary cities are, again, just another aberration of whether we are a nation that is made of immigrants, but also a nation of laws. That's what President Clinton said. That's what President Obama said. That's what Barbara Jordan, who was the last person to chair a bipartisan commission on immigration, also stated, that we are a nation of laws. And the nation of laws is that the Congress sets the law for immigration. We have about 1.1 million legal immigrants who can come into the United States under the proper process. And we currently have over 2 million that are coming in illegal ways. And the fact that they're going to sanctuary cities, I think that we're seeing those sanctuary cities are reaping what has been sown with them. There is a humanitarian positive idea behind it. But when the rule of law is broken down, what ends up happening is that people are coming in, they're taking advantage of the systems. They're overwhelming their healthcare systems, they're overwhelming the social services. They're costing those cities an enormous cost in education for the amount of teachers and language issues they have to be able to address. And so there's just a tremendous downside because of the numbers associated with rampant illegal immigration. And having sanctuary cities just exacerbates that. It sends a message to the world, come across the border illegally, and once you're in, come to a city where you cannot be prosecuted for being in the United States illegally.
Do we know at this moment, based on the recent story about the U.S. government flying migrants into the United States, or immigrants into the United States, do we know whether they are being flown in? Are they being flown in if they're seeking asylum, or are they being flown in if they're not seeking asylum? Do we know the answer to that question yet, James?
Yeah, they're being flown in under the auspices of they are seeking asylum. You know, that situation is really set up in the law for the person who's here legally on a legal visa and has come into an inner city and at that time decides that they want to seek asylum. So you think about the athlete or the scientist or the doctor who has gotten themselves to the United States in a interior city under legal auspices, then they seek asylum. That's what's intended for that type of asylum process.
Right.
It's not to allow people from any four countries to be flown in and come to a city in the dark of night and be bussed away before anybody can see what's going on.
And all that
to be hidden from the American public.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And again, if they're asked the question and they just say, I want to seek asylum, is that good enough to have them passed into the country? Or do they have to answer a question a different way?
They have to be able to pass the screening of what's called credible fear.
Mm-hmm.
And the credible fear is supposed to be done by a judge and adjudicated by that mm-hmm. judge. What's happening now is you have border agents who are specifically there to be able to make this determination. And they're deciding, it's a legal issue, but they're deciding whether the fear that the person has is credible. And all they really have to say is that, yes, I fear for my life. If I go back to my country, I'll be killed. And it's because of my gender, because of my race, because of my political opinions. And then a court needs to decide. And that's what's going on is after that determination has been made, they're allowed into the country.
James,
what we're indicating is the law is supposed to have
James,
been detained until that.
We are out of time. James Massa has been our guest this evening. He is with Numbers USA. You can look him up on the internet. Numbers USA. Our thanks to Judith Sherwin and also to Stephen Maynard Caliendo for being with us this evening. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Fritz Goldman. Good night from Chicago.